Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is May 30th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here for the next installment of the French, quote-unquote, revolution. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. I believe you mentioned that you wanted to give a recap, brief summary of what we've covered so far.
Well, yeah, just to catch people up before we start. We're at page 10 in Nestor Webster's, in the first chapter of Nestor Webster's World Revolution. And that PDF file, if anybody wants it for themselves, well, I mean, we'll be reading only the first two chapters of it, but it's an excellent source, and it's on the MK, it's on the Mein Kampf Project site at ChrisTeganiya.org, and it's in the audio archive for last week's program. There's a link to this PDF file. But basically, Nesta Webster, she starts this World Revolution book discussing the French Revolution. She wrote a separate book on the French Revolution, but that would be a little voluminous for our purposes here. We're a lot better off with these two first chapters as an overview. And the narrative she starts begins with Rousseau. And I guess that's because most people consider him the intellectual inspiration, or they use him so that they have an intellectual inspiration to point to in inciting the French Revolution. The real intellectual inspiration, I believe, are the Jews and crypto-Jews of France. Rousseau romanticizes the idea of a return to some long-lost primitive utopia as an ideal in the minds of the French reading classes. And he was heavily read in the French nobility. Rousseau's ideas promoted communism as a natural economic system for both man and beast, and nothing, as Webster points out, could be further from the truth. Webster also points out that both Rousseau and Voltaire were Freemasons, but the conspiracy against the nobles and the middle classes and the theological classes of France, that the priestly classes and the church, it goes back, as Webster points out, to the 12th century with the Confrères de la Paix, which had a communist worldview and launched the first social attacks on the nobility of France.
I was going to say, when you talked about how he was preaching communism and how it goes back to the 12th century, their basic doctrine, we could say, is that they believe private property is an artificial social construct invented by the elite to remain in power and entrench themselves, correct?
Right, and communism as a doctrine goes back long, much before the 12th century, but it started to come into vogue in France amongst certain classes in the 12th century.
All right.
The like-minded Albigeois followed in the 13th century. In 1250, a Hungarian ex-priest named Jacobi reignited the same crusade against priests and nobles. And around that same time, the Order of the Templars was founded in Jerusalem. In the early 14th century, several Templars were arrested in France for publicly displaying anti-Christian sentiments. This ultimately led to the prosecution, or some people might think persecution, of Templars and the execution of Jacques du Molay, where Webster relates that the survivors of the Templars founded the Freemasons. Now, what Webster didn't get into is all of the usual tales about Jacques du Molay being persecuted for his wealth by the French king and the Pope. She didn't touch on that at all.
That's what mainstream historians usually discuss, isn't it?
Well, right. And I myself usually, I usually suspect those tales as being exaggerated or bogus.
Well, they came about after the fact, didn't they?
Yes. Webster relates that the survivors of the Templars founded the Freemasons. I haven't studied the issue concerning Dumoulin in depth enough to make a conclusive statement on it. However, I believe personally that the idea that the Pope and the French king persecuted Dumoulin only to seize his wealth is probably propaganda.
Absolutely. For a conspiracy that involved, they'd have to be on the exact same page. And if they're willing to screw somebody over and kill him for his wealth, then they'd probably argue amongst themselves about who gets the larger share of the wealth.
And they were both powerful enough together to just take it, that they didn't have to hide the fact. On pages 6 to 7 of World Revolution, Webster is defensive of British Freemasonry, and she also is in the introduction to her book. But she tries to distinguish it from continental Freemasonry. She explains how the lodges of French Freemasonry, especially the Grand Orient Lodge, which the French Revolution was ultimately launched from, as well as that of other continental countries, particularly Italy, became centers of political intrigue. We then see how the philosophies of Jewry, especially Portuguese Jewry, infested the French Masons. On pages 8 to 9, Webster introduces us to Adam Weishaupt, another former priest, a former Jesuit priest, who founded the Illuminati. Webster describes Weishaupt's ideals, and it is easy to see that they are all Jewish ideals, and they are those same ideals which we see later on in the Protocols of Zion and in the Communist Manifesto, which are anti-Christian. They are contrary to all of the culture, morals, industry, and artistic creativeness of our race. Weishaupt founded an order which would seek the destruction of all religion to be replaced by man as his own God. And that in itself is the ideal of the Jewish Talmud. So here we are on page 10.
Now, why do you think it is that she defends British Freemasonry so vigorously? Just because it's British?
It seems to me to be an almost personal defense. And I can't say, I think she may have had, or her husband being an ambassador, may have had some personal involvement in British Freemasonry. That's the idea I get. I don't think that British Freemasonry was any less infiltrated than French Freemasonry.
It may have just taken a little bit longer. Since British Freemasonry was transplanted to the United States, the colonies, and I would...
And that was entirely infiltrated by the time of the Jefferson administration.
Yes, but I would highly doubt the Founding Fathers, if they were infiltrated Masons as opposed to genuine American patriots, they wouldn't have led the revolution like they did. They wouldn't have given us a Declaration of Independence and a Constitution. They would have screamed about peace, land, and bread, and heads would have been rolling.
Well, we see that all of the intrigues, especially those of the Masons, but all of the intrigues and all of the Templars and the Jacobins and all of the groups building up to the French Revolution, all of these groups that were subversive in Europe were anti-Christian, they were anti-nobility, and they were pro-communist. Now, the founding fathers of this nation were not They were anti-Catholic, but they were never anti-Christian. They were all Christians.
Correct. I think that they were just against any sort of ecclesiastical hierarchy trying to establish itself in this country.
Right. Now, they were also anti-nobility, but they were never anti-wealth. That they recognized property rights fully, where the subversives in Europe did not recognize property rights. They were all communists. that they wanted to take the property out of the hands of the churches and the middle class, which the founding fathers of this nation never would have thought of doing.
None of them even advocated that.
Never, not at any time. And there were some very wealthy people in this country at that time and very early. But they never advocated that. That they had full faith in free trade and a man's ability to work in order to build himself wealth.
Absolutely. And that is the most natural law. That is the basic foundation of any civilization, that you keep what you create.
And so we see that the founding fathers of this nation and the so-called, who were the so-called revolutionaries, the leading revolutionaries against King George and the English monarchy and British tyranny, that they were nothing like the revolutionaries of Europe. At any time. That's all I was going to say.
I was going to say they never advocated an overthrow of culture, religion, society. They just wanted self-governance.
Right, and they sought to preserve the culture that was here, and the religion, and the society.
Communists, they'll make an appeal to cultural issues, but then when things are said and done, they totally obliterate the culture.
Exactly.
And they replace it with an imposed artificial Bolshevik culture.
Right. And we cannot ever, because of that drastic difference in ideals between the American revolutionaries and who we call the founding fathers of this nation, and all of the European revolutionaries, it's absolutely clear that the American revolutionaries sought to do well and to do right and to do what was just, and they were by no means affected by the Jews and the Jesuits who had infiltrated all of the European institutions and sought to subvert Christian culture.
Whereas those in America, they were basically just patriots rising up to secure their rights.
Okay, page 10, World Revolution.
All right. Shall I begin or will you?
Be my guest.
After deliverance from the bondage of religion, the loosening of all social ties must follow. Both family and national life must cease to exist so as to make of the human race one good and happy family. The origins of patriotism and the love of kindred are thus described by Weishaupt in the directions given to his Hierophants for the instructions of initiates. At the moment when men united themselves in the nations, they ceased to recognize themselves under a common name. Nationalism or national love took the place of universal love. And this has absolutely never existed, has it?
Well, it's never existed, but we have the white race in the Tower of Babel story pretty much united as one common people when Yahweh, our God, established the nations.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that Weishaupt would oppose that.
Mm.
He and the Jew stand in opposition to the creation of God, who is the author of race and national boundaries. And that's even recognized in the New Testament, Acts chapter 17, verse 26. Paul recognizes that and defends it. So we see that Weishaupt is basically taking the Jewish position, which has always sought, the adversaries of our God have always sought to destroy national boundaries.
Exactly.
And to destroy racial distinctions.
And Paul wrote to the Corinthians, the Ephesians, the Romans, he didn't write to my brothers of the world.
Exactly.
With the division of the globe and its countries, benevolence restricted itself behind boundaries that it was never again to transgress. Then it became a virtue to spread out at the expense of those who did not happen to be under our dominion. Then, in order to attain this goal, it became permissible to despise foreigners and to deceive and to offend them. This virtue was called patriotism. That man was called a patriot who, whilst just towards his own people, was unjust to others, who blinded himself to the merits of foreigners and took for perfections the vices of his own country. Well, under a Marxist-Leninist system, they bring everybody under the same roof and treat them all as just the same, equally miserably.
Yes.
No one sees that patriotism gave birth to localism, to the family spirit, and finally to egoism. Here they are again attacking the family. They hate the family. If this kind
well,
of
right,
tyrannic-
and this is a false, he's making very false distinctions here.
He's using pseudo-scientific arguments, and it seems like he's a front-runner to the Frankfurt School and to the authoritarian ideology.
Well, as we've seen, egoism has always been promoted by the Jew. The star culture has always been promoted by the Jew. And what egoism does is it breaks the fabric of the family spirit and localism, because it is actually the man trying to vaunt himself above his brethren. And that's, in essence, anti-patriotic.
Absolutely. Thus, the origin of states or governments of civil society was the seat of discord, and patriotism found its punishment in itself. Diminish, do away with this love of country, and men will once more learn to know and love each other as men. There will be no more partiality. The ties between hearts will unroll and extend. In these words, the purest expression of internationalism as it is expounded today. Weishaupt displayed an ignorance of primeval conditions of life as profound as that of Rousseau. And I would say he didn't have an ignorance. He knew exactly what he was teaching was contrary to natural conditions. And
I would believe so. He knew exactly what he was teaching would promote Jewish ideals in the Talmud.
The idea of Paleolithic man, whose skeleton is usually exhumed with a flint instrument or other weapon of warfare grasped in its hand, passing his existence in a state of universal love, is simply ludicrous. It was not, however, in his diatribes against civilization that Weishaupt surpassed Rousseau, but in the plan he devised for overthrowing it. Rousseau had merely paved the way for revolution. Weishaupt constructed the actual machinery of revolution itself. It was on the 1st of May, 1776, that Weishaupt's 5 years of meditation resulted in his founding the secret society that he named, after bygone philosophical systems, the Illuminati. All the members were required to adopt classical names. Thus, Weishaupt took the name of Spartacus, the leader of an insurrection of slaves in ancient Rome. His principal ally, Herr von Sack, privy counselor to Prince von Salm, became Cato, the Marquis de Constanza Diomedes, Massenhausen, Ajax, Hertel, Marius, the Baron von Schruckenstein, Mohammed, the Baron Mengenhofen, Cilia, etc. And I have to assume that the Spartacus League took their name from Weishaupt.
I want to know how Muhammad is a classical name.
Well, I'm guessing the Baron von Schrokenstein is a Jew.
Diomedes was a hero of Troy. Ajax was a hero of Troy. Those men were actually what we would consider in medieval times knights, the Greek equivalent.
And they were patriots.
Well, absolutely. They were patriots for the Danans. Spartacus was very likely a Judean slave in southern Italy, or the descendant of Judean slaves in southern Italy. Sulla was a Roman, he was a member of the Roman triumvirate and a Roman general.
Oh, wouldn't that be Sulla with a U, though? They spelled it S-Y-L-L-A.
Yes. I don't know of any other.
Oh, okay.
I really don't know of any other. I'm assuming that is what she meant.
He became the first military dictator, didn't he? He marched on Rome.
He may have, but I think he was involved in a civil war.
I was wondering why they would.
And I don't know the details enough, but he was involved in a civil war.
It seems they've chosen these names in a very mocking fashion, then.
Cato was a philosopher. He was a Roman philosopher, but the libertarians, that they take their pride and their inspiration, a lot of it, from Cato. However, Cato was also an imperialist. Cato ended every one of his speeches with the phrase, Carthage must be destroyed.
He's the one who coined that, Carthago delenda est.
Yes, Carthage must be destroyed.
Right. In the same way the names of places were changed to those celebrated in antiquity, Munich, the headquarters of the system, was to be known as Athens. Ingolstadt, the birthplace of Illuminism, as Ephesus. or to the adepts initiated into the inner mysteries of the order, as Eleusis, Heidelberg as Utica, Bavaria as Achaia, Suabia as Pannonia, etc. For greater secrecy and correspondence, the word Illuminism was to be replaced by the cipher, and then it shows a symbol, and the word Lodge by a symbol of a square. The calendar also was to be reconstructed, and the months known by names suggested of Hebrew origin, January as Dima, February as Benme, etc. Am I butchering those words?
Only some of them.
Okay. For the letters of the alphabet, a complete code of figures was constructed, beginning with M as number 1 and working back to A and on to Z. The grades of the order were a combination of the grades of Freemasonry and the degrees belonging to the Jesuits. Weishaupt, as has already been said, detested the Jesuits, but recognizing the efficiency of their methods in acquiring influence over the minds of their disciples, he conceived the idea of adopting their system to his own purpose. He admired, says the Abbé Barula, the institutions of the founders of this order. He admired above all those laws, that regime of the Jesuits, which under one head made so many men dispersed all over the universe tend towards the same object. He felt that one might imitate their methods whilst proposing to himself views diametrically opposed. He said to himself, "What all these men have done for altars and empires, why should I not do against altars and empires? By the attraction of mysteries, of legends, of adepts, why should I not destroy in the dark what they erect in the light of day?" And that to me shows that he's a straight-up Kabbalistic Jew, isn't he? Talking about working in dark. I mean, that's condemned in Scripture.
Well, yes, and that's what they do. That's what the Talmudists do. Look at the government. The government makes nighttime raids here. Well, when you see that the forces of darkness literally operating in the darkness, know that the Jew is in charge.
Weishaupt at first entertained hopes of persuading other ex-Jesuits to join the society, but having succeeded in enlisting only two, he became more than ever the enemy of their order, and injunctions were given to his adepts to admit no Jews or Jesuits to the sect of the Illuminati unless by special permission. Ex-Jesuits, he wrote emphatically, must be avoided as the plague. So he's probably encountering a lot of people that disagree with the Jesuit order because it's corrupt and they want to reform it, or they want to start an actual decent order. They don't want to overthrow all society and bathe themselves in blood. He's probably having a hard time finding Bolshevik revolutionaries is what the issue is. So that's why he's ranting about them.
And let me correct myself. Spartacus was probably a Spartan. And I'm saying that from his name. I thought that the uprising of Spartacus was a little later. He was either a Spartan or possibly a Thracian.
Hmm.
He wasn't a Judean.
Didn't they refer to him as the Thracian? Because he was taken captive in Thrace.
The name almost sounds like it should mean little Spartan. And I could be wrong about that, but that's how the genitive of Sparta.
So if Weishaupt were around today, and he couldn't find enough people in France that wanted to rise up and engage in massive genocide and murder and mayhem, he would just send out a notice and hire some Chinamen, wouldn't he?
Well, isn't that what the Bolsheviks did?
Absolutely.
Hired Chinamen and Lithuanians and everything else they could get their hands on from just knowing that those people would be hostile to the native Russians?
Whereas in his case, he brought in the Moors from southern France. Whereas you can't make an appeal to those people. If they're getting ready to shoot you and you say, you know, brother, this isn't right. They're not your brother. They don't care about you. They're going to shoot you. They've been paid to do it.
It's an old trick, and the Romans did it, and the Assyrians did it before the Romans, that they would take peoples from one region and pit them against peoples in another. The Romans took slaves of the British and put them to work as soldiers in Judea, and slaves of the Germans and put them to work as soldiers in Africa. And they take slaves of the Carthaginians in Africa and put them to work to work against the Britons in Britain. And what's a Carthaginian going to care about a Breton?
And, you know, the thing is, they accused the Germans of massacring millions in the Soviet Union as they advanced across the wide stretches of the Ukraine, Belarus, and the Baltic states. But I've seen hundreds of pictures of German soldiers helping wounded Soviet soldiers. And I've also seen pictures of Ukrainian civilians showering them with flowers and blowing kisses at them as the German soldiers are advancing. And when the Commissar order came out, ordering that all suspected or identified communists and commissars be executed immediately upon capture, most troops didn't want to enforce it because they didn't look down on the Russians. Well, they certainly looked down on the Jews and the communists, but they didn't necessarily want to just go around killing everyone that somebody else said, oh, that person's a commissar, that person's a communist. Because if I have a gripe with you, I could easily just point my finger at you and say, he's a commissar.
It was clear from Russia number one that the Ukrainians saw the German soldiers at, in 1917 and 1918 who were occupying the Ukraine as saviors.
Absolutely. But now if they'd have been Chinamen, you can't make an appeal to them. You can't say, hey, our countries are right next to each other. We have this shared culture, these shared similarities in our language. We've been allies, you know, several centuries ago, you know, don't hurt our people. You can't make that appeal. They'll just bayonet you and chop your head off. And that's why these revolutionaries always bring in foreigners. They have no ties to the land. And it's not just foreigners by geography, it's foreigners by blood as well.
Well, right.
I guarantee you, they just
been using. Now, I mean, that's the mouth, that's the flood that comes from the mouth of Satan. You know, the Jews have been using the other races against our race since the dawn of time.
They just crossed over into Belgium and said to some Belgians, hey, you want to go kill some Franks? Most of the Belgians would probably tell them to go sit on it. Look what happened with the Hessians in this country. Something about a third of all the Hessian mercenaries they brought over here stayed after the war ended.
Well, that term mercenary in relation to the Hessians, that is in itself a deception. Those men weren't mercenaries.
Well, from what I've read, they were contracted by the Elector Prince of Hesse-Cassel. He was paid to provide an army, so he basically just went around and said to people that were in prison or in jail, okay, you're in the army, you're in the army. If they caught you drunk in public, boom, they crack you over the head and now you're in the army.
Well, right. Most of those Hessians had no choice but to be here.
And
it was the Prince of Hesse who was paid.
Yes, he was the only one who was paid.
So they really weren't mercenaries.
They weren't mercenaries in the sense that we know the word today. They were basically impressed into service, and only the elite guy hiring was paid. They were given what they were told was adequate pay in the form of your uniform and your food.
Exactly.
And that's why most of them stayed.
Yeah, most of them
majority.
Disappeared.
In fact, it prompted a debate on whether German would become a recognized national language in this country.
Well, there was a huge German population here before that.
All right.
That there was in Pennsylvania, there was a huge German population. In New York and New Jersey, there was still a sizable Dutch population.
Right.
And they're basically German. Yeah, you know, they speak a dialect of German, basically.
Absolutely.
But in the Mohawk Valley in New York, there was a huge German population in central New York. That there's a city on the Hudson River called Rhineland. And there's several other cities that betray their German origin.
Before we get back to the reading here, let me ask you, how many massacres do you know of that the Hessians perpetrated against the residents of New Jersey when they were in New Jersey? Can you name one?
Well, no, there are none.
Exactly. They didn't want to massacre their cousins. It was in training of adepts that Weishaupt showed his profound subtlety. Proselytes were not to be admitted at once to the secret aims of Illuminism, but initiated step by step into the higher mysteries, just like Masonry. And the greatest caution was to be exercised not to reveal to the novice doctrines that might be likely to revolt him.
Well, it's also just like Kabbalahism.
Hmm. Well, if they told you on day one, hey, you're going to be worshiping Satan, most people would run, wouldn't they?
It's also very much like the ancient pagan temple mysteries of the Greeks, which were kept secret. I don't know if any Greek writer ever really revealed them.
All right.
Herodotus talked about some things that weren't lawful for him to repeat, which went on in Greek temples because they were bound to secrecy.
For this purpose, the initiators must acquire the habit of talking backwards and forwards so as not to commit themselves. One must speak, Weishaupt explained, to the superiors of the order, sometimes in one way, sometimes in another, so that our real purpose should remain impenetrable to our inferiors.
That's a Jewish trait all the way.
100%. Exactly. This sounds like Albert Pike when he said it is right and just to deceive the lower ranks when he referred to Freemasonry. He said that lower Masons deserve to be deceived. And only a Pharisee or a Sadducee would be okay talking out of both sides of their mouth like that. Thus, to certain novices, the novicei ecosiis, the Illuminati must profess to disapprove of revolutions and demonstrate the advantages of proceeding by peaceful methods towards the attainment of world domination. But to the Minerval, the plan of world power must not be revealed. On the contrary, one of the opening sentences in the initiation of this grade runs as follows. After 2 years' reflection, experience, intercourse, reading of the graduated writings and information, you will necessarily have formed the impression that the final aim of our society is nothing less than to win power and riches, to undermine secular or religious government, and to obtain the mastery of the world. Que scuse se accuse, indeed. The passage then goes on to say vaguely that this is not the case, and that the order only demands of the initiate the fulfillment of his obligations. Nor must antagonism to religion be admitted. On the contrary, Christ was to be represented as the first author of Illuminism, whose secret mission was to restore men, to restore to men the original liberty and equality they had lost in the fall. That's absolutely disgusting and perverse. Christ said that he would teach, he would make things known that had been concealed since the foundation of the world. He wouldn't be working at night covertly in a conspiratorial fashion, would he?
Absolutely not.
No one, the novice should be told, paved so sure a way for liberty as our Grand Master, Jesus of Nazareth. And if Christ exhorted his disciples to despise riches, it was in order to prepare the world for that community of goods that should do away with property.
Which is a total lie.
Absolutely.
All of the community in the New Testament is voluntary and amongst fellow believers of good moral standing.
Well, even when he spoke to the rich man, and who told him, I have kept all the commandments, what do I lack? And he said, if you wish to be perfect, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. He never told him, you're not going to heaven. But he said, if you wish to be perfect, and how many people can attain perfection?
Right, and the New Testament fully recognizes the right of an individual to maintain his property.
This device proved particularly successful not only with the young novices, but with men of all ranks and ages. The most admirable thing of all, wrote Spartacus triumphantly to Cato, is that great Protestant and Reformed theologians, Lutherans and Calvinists, who belong to our order, really believe they see in it the true and genuine mind of the Christian religion. Oh man, what cannot you be brought to believe? End quote. And I'm sure that if this revolution had come about in country after country, they'd all be up against the wall and shot as useful idiots, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
In fact, the Duke d'Orléans lost his head. They always eat their own. By this means, as Philo, the Baron von Nige, later on pointed out, the order was able to tickle those who have a hankering for religion. Just the exact same way the Bolsheviks take people interested in genuine social reform who oppose the disgusting overt abuses of the capitalist system, they get them to work for the Bolshevik cause, and no genuine social reform is ever forthcoming. And in fact, when they ask the commissars, okay, now that we're in power, where are all those social reforms that you promised me? They're getting a bullet in the back, aren't they? It was not then, until his admission to the higher grades, that the adept was initiated into the real intentions of Illuminism with regard to religion. When he reached the grade of illuminated major or minor of Scotch Knight, Epopte, or priest, he was told the whole secret of the order in a discourse by the initiator. Remember that from the first invitations which we have given you in order to attract you to us, we commenced by telling you that in the projects of our order there did not enter any designs against religion. You remember that such an assurance was given you when you were admitted into the ranks of our novices, and that it was repeated when you entered into our Minerval Academy. You remember with what art, with what simulated respect we have spoken to you of Christ and of his gospel, but in the grades of greater Illuminism, of Scotch Knight and of Epopte or priest, how we have known, how we have to know, to form from Christ's gospel, that are of our reason and from its religion, that of nature and from religion, reason, morality, and nature, to make the religion and morality of the rights of man, of equality, and of liberty. We have had many prejudices to overcome in you before being able to persuade you that the pretend religion of Christ was nothing else than the work of priests, of impostors, and of tyranny. If it be so with that religion so much proclaimed and admired, what are we to think of other religions? Understand, then, that they have all found the same fictions for their origin, that they are all equally founded on lying, error, chimera, and imposture. Behold our secret. If in order to destroy all Christianity, all religion, we have pretended to have the sole true religion, remember that the end justifies the means, and that the wise ought to take all the means to do good, which the wicked take to do evil. Those which we have taken to deliver you, those which we have taken to deliver one day the human race from all religion, are nothing else than a pious fraud, which we reserve to unveil one day in the grade of magus or philosopher illuminated. And I have to wonder here, if the tree is poisoned, can it ever have good fruit? So if lies are at the foundation of their system and their ideology, how can the truth ever come out of this system or ideology?
Well, it's a Jewish system. It's a Jewish ideology. It's perfectly clear.
It looks to me like this just came straight out of the Talmud.
Absolutely. Anything goes in order to gain your end, which is the destruction of Christianity.
Do whatever you need to do to achieve whatever it is you want.
Or the corruption of some young woman. Yeah,
lie, cheat, steal, and defraud people, and then call it holy because you're trying to liberate them. But all this was unknown to the novice, whose confidence being won by the simulation of religion was enjoined to strict obedience. Amongst the questions put to him were the following. If you came to discover anything wrong or unjust to be done under the order, what line would you take? Will you and can you regard the good of the order as your own good? Will you give to our society the right of life and death? Do you bind yourself to absolute and unreserved obedience? And do you know the force of this undertaking? By way of warning as to the consequences of betraying the order, a forcible illustration was included in the ceremony of initiation. Taking a naked sword from the table, the initiator held the point against the heart of the novice with these words, "If you are only a traitor and perjurer, learn that all our brothers are called upon to arm themselves against you. Do not hope to escape or to find a place of safety. Wherever you are, shame, remorse, and the rage of our brothers will pursue you and torment you to the innermost recesses of your entrails." This sounds Masonic and Kabbalistic. It will thus be seen that the liberty vaunted by the leaders of the Illuminati had no existence, and that iron discipline was in reality the watchword of the order. A great point impressed upon the adepts, of which we shall see the importance later, was that they should not be known as Illuminati. This rule was particularly enforced in the case of those described as enrollers, and by way of attracting proselytes, they were further admonished to be irreproachable. The superiors of the order are to be regarded as the most perfect and enlightened of men. They must not even permit any doubts of their infallibility. Don't we see this today with the so-called critics and purveyors of culture who announce that they are the truly enlightened people and we're all just ignorant bumpkins since we don't drool at their feet?
Well, right. They've created they've substituted our real culture with their artificial culture, and only they can be experts at it.
Therefore, to the enrollers, it was said, apply yourself to inward and outward perfection, but also apply yourself to the art of counterfeit, of hiding and masking yourselves when observing others, so as to penetrate into their minds. Die Kunst zu erlernen, andere zu beobachten und auszuforschen. These precepts were summed up in the one phrase, keep silence, be perfect, mask yourselves. If you're perfect, why do you need to mask yourself? How far the founder of the order had himself attained perfection was subsequently revealed by the discovery of his papers, amongst which was found a letter from Weishaupt to Hertel, in 1783, confessing that he had seduced his sister-in-law
and adding, I am therefore in danger of losing my honor and that reputation which gave me so much authority over the world. He sounds like a typical Jew.
So much for masking yourself, he can't even keep quiet.
And wouldn't the Talmud say that if you've committed a sin, don't confess it in a letter to someone else, forget about it, and enjoy the fact that you got away with it? That's what the Talmud would teach. Am I right?
I think that his ego wouldn't let him keep his mouth shut.
So he's basically writing a letter bragging rather than writing a letter confessing.
That's what I would think.
For a time, this reputation for perfectibility was successfully maintained for the benefit of the members, who would have been revolted by a breach of morality, and only those likely to be attracted by it were to be allowed to know of the laxity permitted by the order.
If reason is to be the new God and Christianity to be done away with, why would Weishaupt admit this as a moral breach? Why would it be a moral breach if reason is God? I don't understand that at all. You could reason your way into any immorality. I mean, it's done all the time. It's done by our people today and by the media and Hollywood all the time.
And the most common argument they make is everyone's doing it.
Situation ethics prevails in society today and has for 60, 70, 80 years. So if reason is Weishaupt's God, I don't see how – I think it's a dichotomy in his thinking that he would consider that a moral breach at all. He could have just reasoned his way – he probably did reason his way into her dress, and he could have reasoned his way out of it.
All right. Women were also to be enlisted as Illuminati by being given hints of emancipation.
And we see that the emancipation of women in all of the Jewish literature of the 19th and 20th centuries.
And we remember exactly how they liberated women in Russia, how they whipped them if they refused to put out for the Jews that wanted them.
Right, they emancipated them from their chastity. That's what they emancipated them from.
They liberated them from the care and protection of their family and household. And they turned them basically into common whores. Through women, wrote Weishaupt, one may often work the best in the world. To insinuate ourselves with these and to win them over should be one of our cleverest strategies, studies.
The serpent was the most subtle of all the beasts of the field.
More or less, they can all be led towards change by vanity, curiosity, sensuality, and inclination. From this can one draw much profit for the good cause. This sex has a large part of the world in its hands. The female adepts were then to be divided into two classes, each with its own secret, the first to consist of virtuous women who would give an air of respectability to the order, the second of light women, quote, who would help to satisfy those brothers who have a penchant for pleasure, end quote. But the present utility of both classes would consist in providing funds for the society. Fools with money, whether men or women, were to be particularly welcomed. These good people, wrote Spartacus to Ajax and Cato, swell our numbers and fill our money box. Set yourselves to work. These gentlemen must be made to nibble at the bait. But let us beware of telling them our secrets. This sort of people must always be made to believe that the grade they have reached is the last. So these are people that join movements and they want to be the highest they can be in any given movement. They don't like to know that there are people above them. They think they're in the top tier, but they're just being used.
32nd degree Masons.
The sect was thus to consist of Weishaupt and the adepts who had been initiated into the inner mysteries, and besides these, of a large following of simple, incredulous people who could be kept in ignorance of the real goal towards which they were being driven. Weishaupt's method for obtaining proselytes is thus shown by a diagram in the Code of the Illuminati. Naturally, the least educated classes offered a wide field for Weishaupt's activities. It is also necessary, runs the Code of the Illuminati, to gain the common people, das geheimen Volk, to our cause. The great means to that end is influence in the schools. One can also succeed now by liberty, now by striking an effect, and at other times by humiliating oneself, by making oneself popular, or enduring with an air of patient prejudices that one can gradually root out later. And I'd say today all the schools are in the pocket of the Jew. Espionage formed a large part of Weishaupt's program. The adepts, known as the Insinuating Brothers, were enjoined to assume the role of observers and reporters. Every person shall be made a spy on another and on all around him. Friends, relations, enemies, those who are indifferent, all without exception, shall be the object of his inquiries. He shall attempt to discover their strong side and their weak, their passions, their prejudices, their connections, above all, their actions. In a word, the most detailed information about them. This sounds like the NKVD.
Well, it's the NKVD, and it was definitely the methods of the Bolsheviks and the communists under Stalin, and even long after that. But it's also the methods that are being used in our society these last 20 or 30 years.
They probably have profiles on all of us in some office somewhere, don't they?
Well, yes, but they encourage our kids in schools to tell on their parents if they're smoking funny cigarettes. They encourage our kids in schools to tell on their parents if they're doing anything illegal at all,
or
they're abusing their children, or for any reason.
They encourage kids to talk about how many guns their parents own. I've seen documentary footage. People go into classrooms and ask, how many of you have seen objects like these in your house? Do your parents have these in their house? Where do they keep them? How many do they have?
Right. That they grill children in schools. If little Johnny falls and gets a bruise, the doctor and the nurses in the emergency room, are you sure your daddy didn't do this? Are you sure he didn't hit you? Are you sure he didn't beat you? Yeah, you know, that's the way they treat it's we are living in a tyrannical society who, with the same people at the helm that we've always had of our tyrannical societies.
All right. All this is to be entered on tablets that the insinuant carries with him, and from which he shall draw up reports to be sent in twice a month to his superiors, so that the order may know which are the people in each town and village to whom it can look for support. More than likely,
the apparatchiks.
More than likely, I'd say it's so the order knows who to kill when they come to power.
Well, that too.
And this just reminds me of what we read about what was going on in Spain, how they drew up detailed reports on everybody years in advance, and they had killing lists, and they had killing squads. It is impossible not to admire the ingenuity of the system by which each section of the community was to be made to believe that it would reap untold benefits from Illuminism. Princes whose kingdoms were to be reft from them, priests and ministers whose religion was to be destroyed, merchants whose commerce was to be ruined, women who were to be reduced to the rank of squaws, peasants who were to be made to return to a state of savagery, were all, by means of dividing up the secrets of the order into watertight compartments, to be persuaded that in Illuminism alone lay their prosperity or salvation. And this is basically the gospel of Satan, isn't it? He says that he will save you when he intends to damn you.
And that's why Satan pretends to be the light bearer, which is what Illuminism actually pretends to signify.
And which is what Masons are referring to when they say, let the brother receive the light. If you push them, Masons will say that Lucifer is the light of the world.
And the only true light is Yahshua Christ.
Absolutely. So they're making a message to nobles saying that you will be elevated from the rank of duke to the rank of archduke or the rank of prince, or you'll be the king, when in reality they're going to be corpses. Secrecy being thus the great principle of his system, Weishaupt had not been slow to perceive the advantages offered by an alliance with Freemasonry. During the period when he was thinking out his plan, the real aims of Masonry were unknown to him. He only knew, says the Abbé Burel, that the Freemasons held secret meetings. He saw them united by a mysterious link and recognizing each other as brothers by certain signs and certain words to whatever nation or religion they belonged. He therefore conceived a new combination of which the result was to be a society adopting for its methods, as far as it suited him, the regime of the Jesuits and the mysterious silence, the obscure existence of the Masons. It was in 1777, nearly 2 years after he had founded the Order of the Illuminati, that Weishaupt became a Freemason, and towards the end of 1778, the idea was first launched of amalgamating the two societies. Cato, that is to say, Herr von Zwack, who became a Mason on November 27, 1778, talked the matter over with a brother Mason, the Abbé Moratai, to whom he confided the whole secret of Illuminism. It seems he just can't keep his mouth shut. And 2 years later, a further understanding between Illuminism and Freemasonry was brought about by a certain Freemason, Freiherr von Nigay, who in July 1780 arrived at Frankfurt, where he met the Illuminatus Diomedes, the Marquis de Constanza, sent by the Bavarian Illuminati to establish colonies in Protestant countries. The two men compared notes on the aims of their respective societies, and Nigay then expressed the wish to be received into the order of the Illuminati. This met with the approval of Weishaupt, and Nigay, adopting the name of Philo, was thereupon initiated into the secrets of the first class of Illuminism, the Minervals. The zeal he displayed in obtaining proselytes delighted Spartacus. Philo, he wrote, is the master from whom to take lessons. Give me 6 men of his stamp, and with them I will change the face of the universe.
Now the real Philo, I consider to be the Freud of antiquity. If you've ever read Philo Judaeus, who this man took his name from, he tried to make a reconciliation between the Hebrew Bible and Greek paganism, but the way he and Greek philosophy, but the way he went about it, it is some of the most convoluted writing I've ever read. I couldn't even read it. I read 4 or 5 pages of it, and I said, the hell with this, I'm never reading Philo, and I put it away. It was like reading a first century Freud.
Convoluted garbage.
Yes, totally convoluted garbage. I just thought I'd mention that because of the esteem in which this man is being held here by Weishaupt.
As a result of the negotiations between Weishaupt and Nigay, a kind of union was arranged between the two societies, and Spartacus agreed to Illuminism receiving the first 3 degrees of Masonry. On the 20th of December, 1781, it was finally decided that the combined order should be composed of 3 classes: A, the Minervals; B, the Freemasons; and C, the Mystery class, which as the highest of all was divided into the lesser and greater mysteries, and the former including the grades of priests and regents, the latter the mages and the men kings. So it seems Masonry is the intermediate stage then.
Yes.
Coming after the Minervals. So that tells me that the Masons at this point have to already be corrupt enough to be eligible to learn that they're overthrowing religion.
I don't really think they understood that. I don't think that most 32nd degree Masons really understand that.
Now, what about the 33rd?
Well, from everything I've read about Masonry, they definitely understand that. But you don't get invited into that degree unless they know that you'll be amenable to that.
So that's why a few 32nd degree Masons have quit and spilled the beans about what they know. But as far as I know, and probably as far as you know, no 33rd degree Mason has ever spilled the beans, have they?
Not that I've read, no.
And I'm sure if there were any, they would kill him. But it was not until the Congrès de Wilhelmsbad that the alliance between Illuminism and Freemasonry was finally sealed. This assembly, of which the importance to the subsequent history of the world has never been appreciated by historians, met for the first time on the 16th of July, 1782, and included representatives of all the secret societies, Martinists, as well as Freemasons and Illuminati, which now numbered no less than 3 million members all over the world.
Now, the Martinists are from that Portuguese Jew that Nestor Webster had spoken about earlier in this chapter, I believe.
So these are basically 3 million apostles of hell.
He was the one that added the line about egalite to the slogan of the Grand Orient Lodge.
This is basically the front runner to the meetings today, where the Bilderbergs meet with the Masons, the Trilaterals, and they're talking about who knows what.
Well, it's orders filtering down from who we perceive to be the leaders of global capitalism-communism-Jewry.
So basically Satan's giving out a briefing.
Well, right. It's that's the way we perceive. I mean, that's the way most students of conspiratorial history, I think, properly perceive all those organizations. That their philosophies trickle down, and that their objectives trickle down through the organizations, and people accept them. Until it gets to levels such as the Council on Foreign Relations and actual policy-making bodies.
And they're told that you'll be perfect, follow these orders, and the world will be perfect and lovely, just like Eve was told, you'll be as God.
Right, and the Council on Foreign Relations isn't a policy-making body in itself, but its members are all policy-making members of society or people who are in positions to push certain policies.
So it's just a coincidence that they would say that they happen to be CEOs, congressmen, senators, judges. Amongst
media figures, yes.
All right. Amongst these different orders, the Illuminati of Bavaria alone had formulated a definite plan of campaign, and it was they who henceforth took the lead. What passed at this terrible Congress will never be known to the outside world, for even those men who had been drawn unwittingly into the movement and now heard for the first time the real designs of the leaders were under oath to reveal nothing. Now, I have to ask, does an oath to a Satanist actually constitute an oath? If the Jews have their Kol Nidre, whereby none of their oaths mean anything, if you're tricked into taking an oath to evil, are you obligated and bound to evil?
I don't think that any man is obligated and bound to an oath when he doesn't understand all of the conditions of the oath.
So basically, these people were tricked into taking an oath. And then
tricked into believing they should uphold it.
Their own personal honor and integrity worked against them. One such honest Freemason, the Comte de Villeray, a member of the Martiniste Lodge at Lyons, returning from the Congrès de Wilhelmsbad, could not conceal his alarm, and when questioned on the tragic secrets he had brought back with him, replied, "I will not confide them to you. I can only tell you that all this is very much more serious than you think. The conspiracy which is being woven is so well thought out that it will be, so to speak, impossible for the monarchy and the church to escape from it." "From this time onwards," says his biographer, M. Costa de Beauregard, "the Comte de Verret could only speak of Freemasonry with horror." The years of 1781 and 1782 were remarkable for the growth of another movement which found expression at the Congrès de Wilhelmsbad, namely the emancipation of the Jews. How shocking. During these years, a wave of pro-Semitism was produced throughout Europe by Dohm's great book, Upon the Civil Amelioration of the Condition of the Jews, written under the influence of Moses Mendelssohn and finished in August 1781. It was thus, wrote the Abbe Liman, that 8 years before the revolution, the program in favor of Judaism was sent out by Prussia. This book had a considerable influence on the revolutionary movement. It is the trumpet call of the Jewish cause, the signal for the great step forward. Gratz, the Jewish historian, himself recognizes the immense importance of Dohm's work, painting the Christians as cruel barbarians and the Jews as illustrious martyrs. "All thinking people," he adds, "now began to interest themselves in the Jewish question. Mirabeau, a few years later on a mission to Berlin, formed a friendship with Dohm and became an habitué of the salon of a young and beautiful Jewess." I don't believe that part. Henriette de Lumos, wife of Dr. Herz, and it was there that the disciples of Mendelssohn, who had just died, pressed him to raise his voice in favor of the oppressed Jews, with the result that Mirabeau published a book in London on the same lines as Dohm's. So here we can see that this is basically Talmudism from the get-go, and now they're being overt about it for anybody who has eyes to see.
I have Gretz's History of the Jews here, and I'm going to investigate this for next week. If I had had time to read ahead this week, the material we were going to cover, I would have done it this week, and I feel bad I didn't do that now. But.
So this is basically the Schofield of the day, right?
Well, it surely seems to be. I mean, you know, in Prussia, The Jews had been bankers to the Prussian nobility for a long time before this.
But they had to live in ghettos, typically, didn't they?
Well, yes, but that they did, at a very early time, gain a lot of influence over the Prussian nobility. And it's only fitting, I think, that this actually comes out of Prussia, right?
And it was worse in Austria, though, wasn't it? Since Austria was the first country to extend nobility titles to the Jews. The Habsburgs.
Did they beat the English to that?
I believe so. They started in the early, the mid-1600s, if I recall properly.
Well, then I guess they probably did.
And I'd like to point out, too, we will get into this later, I hope, at some point, that many of the kings of France, after Henry II, were ethnically Jewish through his marriage to Catherine de' Medici. The de' Medicis infiltrated the French monarchy very early on in terms of the modern French monarchy.
Well, it was only that's only fitting because it was Charlemagne admitted the Jews to France during his reign because he found their for economic reasons that they were worth having around.
So again, he let money decide the course of the nation.
And that happened in the 9th century.
And the Grand Dukes of Tuscany, they were overt de' Medicis. In fact, when the de' Medicis had to flee Florence in 1490, they were doing so because the citizens formed a Catholic theocracy, rose up against the Jewish usury system. They expelled every single Jew they could find from Florentine territory, along with the de' Medicis. The de' Medicis were told, you leave too, or else. So I assume the citizens of Florence knew the score. They know who was who and who was Jew. And we should get into that at some point later down the road.
Well, yes, we should, because the de' Medici supplied 3 popes to the Catholic Church in the 1500s.
I think it was 4, wasn't it?
I believe it was 3. Three, four, what's the difference?
Okay, good point. And they also provided the Grand Dukes of Tuscany, several kings of France. I mean, we really need to talk about them later on.
During the 1500s, the Catholic Church actually legitimized usury in Christian Europe by changing its definition from the loaning of money at interest to the loaning of money at too much interest.
So they've just established a level for gauging whether or not evil is really evil based upon how much evil is present.
Well, basically, yes.
All right. Meanwhile, in 1781, Anacharsis Clootz, the future author of La République Universelle, wrote his pro-Semitic pamphlet called Lettres sur les Juifs. And I think that just says letters...
For the Jews. The Jews.
In favor of or to the... The result of this agitation was seen later in the edicts passed through the influence of Mirabeau and the Abbé Grégory by the National Assembly in 1791 decreeing the emancipation of the Jews. A more immediate effect, however, was the resolution taken at the Masonic Congress of Wilhelmsbad, which was attended by Lessing and a company of Jews. I'd like to point out first about the National Assembly emancipating Jews. At some point, after I've read The French Revolution in San Domingo, I will make several show topics on this. The National Assembly back in France called upon all the black slaves in Haiti to rise up and massacre the whites if the whites would not recognize their emancipation or if the whites showed what they termed essentially counter-revolutionary tendencies. They said basically if the whites on the island move to arm themselves and organize, feel free to massacre them. Paris supports you. So that should tell you what revolution this was. This was a Jewish revolution from the very onset, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
So they're emancipating Jews while calling on Negroes to massacre whites. And I'll read the last sentence again. A more immediate effect, however, was the resolution taken at the Masonic Congress of Wilhelmsbad, which was attended by Lessing and a company of Jews, that henceforth Jews should no longer be excluded from the lodges. At the same time, it was decided to remove the headquarters of Illuminized Freemasonry to Frankfurt, which incidentally was the stronghold of Jewish finance, controlled at this date by such leading members of the race as Rothschild, Meyer Amschel, later to become Rothschild. Also Oppenheimer, Wertheimer, Schuster, Speer, Stern, and others. Those sound like great German names to me. At this head lodge of Frankfurt, the gigantic plan of world revolution was carried forward, and it was there that at a large Masonic Congress in 1786, two French Freemasons afterwards declared the deaths of Louis XVI and Gustavus III of Sweden were definitely decreed. From the moment,
well, there you have it. That's a Jewish war on Christendom. As soon as they get, as soon as the Jesuits infiltrate into Freemasonry, the Jews followed immediately.
Because the Jesuits are just crypto Jews.
Well, I believe that the Jesuits are basically an organization of crypto Jews that the Jews have operated from throughout the Middle Ages, from the time of their founding, in order to use the guise of Christianity to influence governments, because the Jews too often could not do that directly.
So when the Jew was given a choice in Spain by a Spaniard holding a dagger to his neck saying, accept Jesus or die, of course they're going to say, oh, I accept your Lord, I accept him, I accept him. Then 3 years later, yeah, he's going to become a priest and ruin the church, which is why Martin Luther said, when someone asked him, how would you baptize a Jew, sir? He said, I would conduct him to a bridge over the River Elbe, tie a millstone around his neck, and push him off the side. And I think Martin Luther, that's the only way that's acceptable for baptizing a Jew. He was right on the money, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Good cannot convert evil. If good attempts to, good will simply be watered down and then become evil. From the moment of the Great Coalition effected at Wilhelmsbad, Illuminism, aided largely by the activities of Nige, was able to extend its ramifications all over Germany. The Lodge of Eichstätt under Muhammad, the Baron Schrokenstein.
Now what kind of German noble would take that as a code name?
He has to be a straight-up crypto.
That's incredible to me.
Illuminated Bayreuth and other imperial towns. Berlin under Nikolai and Luchtenring. Illuminated the province of Brandenburg and Pomerania. Frankfurt illuminated Hanover, and so on. All these branches were controlled by the 12 leading adepts headed by Weishaupt, who at the lodge in Munich held in his hands the threads of the whole conspiracy. But dissensions had now begun amongst the two principal leaders, Weishaupt and Nige. Both were indeed born intriguers, but whilst Weishaupt preferred to work in the dark and wrap himself in mystery, Nige loved to make a noise in the world and to meddle with everything. It was inevitable that two such men could not continue to work together harmoniously, and before long, Nige's persistent attempts to pry into Weishaupt's secrets and to usurp a share of his glory roused the animosity of his chief, who ended up depriving Nige of his post as director of the provinces and placing him in a subordinate position. Sounds like Trotsky versus Stalin, evil bickering with evil. What would you say?
Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, yeah, same thing all over again, right?
Whereat Philo, on the 20th of January, 1783, wrote indignantly to Cato, it is the Jesuitry of Weishaupt that caused all our divisions. It is the despotism that he exercises over men perhaps less rich than himself in imagination and ruses and cunning.
Well, Lenin and Trotsky, in that war, there wasn't so much division because they just eliminated one.
Hmm.
And then Stalin just eliminated his rivals. So this is it's a softer Jewish takeover. It's a subtle Jewish takeover. That they didn't have the ability to just eliminate their rivals. Not overtly, anyway.
I declare that nothing can put me on the same footing with Spartacus as that on which I was at first. As a matter of fact, Nige was in no way behind Weishaupt in what he described as Jesuitry, but revolted by the tyranny of his leader, he finally left the Illuminati in anger and disgust. I abhor treachery and profligacy, he wrote again to Cato, and I leave him to blow himself and his order into the air. Public opinion had now, however, become thoroughly roused on the subject of the society, and the Elector of Bavaria, informed of the danger to the state constituted by its adepts, who were said to have declared that the Illuminati must in time rule the world, published an edict forbidding all secret societies. Well, how do you enforce that? They're secret.
Exactly. Yeah, you can't enforce that edict.
That's like saying mafia members stop working covertly behind the scenes to manipulate organized labor. In April of the following year, 1785, four other Illuminati, who like Nige, had left the society disgusted by the tyranny of Weishaupt, were summoned before a court of inquiry to give an account of the doctrines and methods of the sect. The evidence of these men, Uchtschneider, Cosande, Grunberger, and Renner, all professors of the Marianan Academy, left no further room for doubt as to the diabolical nature of Illuminism. All religion, they declared, all love of country and loyalty to sovereigns were to be annihilated, a favorite maxim of the order being tu les bras et tu les prêtres sont des frappons et des traites. And I butchered some of that. And
well,
I don't know
it's butchered and I can't even interpret. I don't know very much French, just a couple of words, and I screw them up sometimes. I have no... Nesta Webster just expects us to read French. That's the bottom line.
So she's not going to put it in English.
No, there's no translation here. I'm sorry.
All right. Would you like to take over from here?
Yes, I'd like to finish this chapter tonight. Moreover, every effort was to be made to create discord, not only between princes and their subjects, but between ministers and their secretaries, and even between parents and children. Tell me this isn't the pattern with the Jews. While suicide was to be encouraged by inculcating in men's minds the idea that the act of killing oneself afforded a certain voluptuous pleasure. Espionage was to be extended even to the post by placing adepts in the post offices who possessed the art of opening letters and closing them again without fear of detection. Robeson, who studied all the evidence of the four professors, thus sums up the plan of Weishaupt as revealed by them. The order of the Illuminati adjured Christianity and advocated sensual pleasures. In the lodges, death was declared an eternal sleep. Patriotism and loyalty were called narrow-minded prejudices and incompatible with universal benevolence. All the same Jewish rhetoric that we've heard for this last 300 years and we hear today all the time.
Oh, Bill, I have a basic translation from a translation program. All the kings and all the word didn't go, are mischievous and traitors. So it would be something that would rhyme with traitors.
Traitors is the last word. Yeah, that makes sense.
All the kings and all the something are mischievous and traitors.
All the patriots, perhaps. Pretres. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that's patriots. I'm not positive. The order of the Illuminati adjured Christianity and advocated sensual pleasures. In the lodges, death was declared an eternal sleep. Patriotism and loyalty were called narrow-minded prejudices and incompatible with universal benevolence. Further, they accounted all princes as usurpers and tyrants, and all privileged orders as their abettors. They meant to abolish the laws which protected property accumulated by long-continued and successful industry, and to prevent for the future any such accumulation. They were straight communists, universal communists. That's the Jew. They intended to establish universal liberty and equality and imprescriptible rights of man.
If you don't have the right fruit of your own labor, though, what rights do you have?
Well, right. They have no rights. It's all a fairy tale. It's the serpent in the garden whispering in the ear his deception.
Saying that by disobeying God, you shall become God.
Absolutely. And as necessary preparations for all this, they intended to root out all religion and ordinary morality and even to break the bonds of domestic life by destroying the veneration for marriage vows and by taking the education of children out of the hands of the parents.
And they've done that today in this society.
Well, we're a communist society too, but we don't even know it. We're too stupid to know it, most of us.
Most people, when I talk to them about homeschooling, they say, oh, the average parent's not qualified to educate their children. You need a teacher to educate their children.
Well, their brains are loaded with Jewish sewage.
Well, then how did our country get by for the first 150 years?
The average teacher knows a lot less than the average parent. Reduced to a simple formula, the aims of the Illuminati may be summarized in the following 6 points. Abolition of all monarchy and all ordered government. Abolition of private property. Abolition of inheritance. Abolition of patriotism. This is the embryo of the Communist Manifesto. Abolition of the family, i.e. of marriage and all morality, and the institution of the communal education of children. Abolition of all religion. And they have basically they've basically achieved all this in the United States today. Now it will surely be admitted that the above forms a program hitherto unprecedented in the history of civilization. Communistic theories had been held by isolated thinkers or groups of thinkers since the days of Plato, and probably before that. But no one, as far as we know, had ever yet seriously proposed to destroy everything for which civilization stands. Moreover, when, as we shall see, the plan of Illuminism, as codified by the above 6 points, has continued up to the present day to form the exact program of world revolution, how can we doubt that the whole movement originated with the Illuminati or with secret influences at work behind them? Here, a curious point arises. Was Weishaupt the inventor of this system? We know that he was indoctrinated in occultism by Kolmar, but beyond this we can discover nothing. If indeed Weishaupt himself thought out his whole plan of world revolution, I would rather think a council of rabbis did, that gigantic conception, as it is described by Louis Blanc, how is it that so vast a genius should have remained absolutely unknown to posterity? How is it that succeeding groups of world revolutionaries, whilst all following in his footsteps, even those who we know positively to have belonged to his order, never once have referred to the source of their inspiration? Is it not the answer to the later question that throughout the movement, the adepts of the order have always adhered to the stringent rule laid down by Weishaupt that they should never allow themselves to be known as Illuminati? The persistent efforts to conceal the very existence of the order, or, if this proves impossible, to represent it as an unimportant philanthropic movement, has continued up to the very year in which I write, which is the 1930s, I believe. With regard to the philanthropic nature of Illuminism, it is only necessary to consult the original writings of Weishaupt to realize the hollowness of this assurance. Amongst the whole correspondence which passed between Weishaupt and his adepts, laid bare by the government of Bavaria, we find no word of sympathy with the poor or the suffering, no hint of social reform, nothing but the desire either for domination, for world power, or sheer love of destruction, and throughout all the insatiable spirit of intrigue. For this purpose, every method was held to be justifiable, since the fundamental doctrine of the sect was that the end sanctifies the means, which Weishaupt referred to in his code, declaring it to be a part of the Jesuit system, an imputation which the Abbe Barul indignantly denies, and which inevitably led, as Robeson points out, to the conclusion that nothing would be scrupled at if it could be made appear that the order would derive advantage from it, because the great object of the order was held as superior to every consideration. As might be expected, Weishaupt loudly protested against the account of his society given by the four professors, declaring that they had not been initiated into its inner mysteries, but the discovery of a little later of his correspondence with Zwack, from which quotations have already been given earlier in this chapter, threw a still more sinister light on the real aims of the order. It was on the 11th of October, 1786, that the Bavarian authorities descended upon the House of Zwack and seized the documents which laid bare the methods of the conspirators. I wonder if they did that at night. Here were found descriptions of a strong box for safeguarding papers, which, if forced open, should blow up by means of an infernal machine, of a composition which should blind or kill if squirted in the face, of a method for counterfeiting seals, recipes for a particularly deadly kind of aqua tofana, for poisonous perfumes that would fill a bedroom with pestilential vapors, and for a tea to procure abortion. A eulogy of atheism entitled Better Than Horus was also discovered.
Horus is an Egyptian sun god, isn't he?
Yes. And a paper in the handwriting of Zwack describing the plan for enlisting women in the two classes mentioned above. Quote, "It will be of great service and procure much information and money and will suit charmingly the tastes of many of our truest members who are the lovers of the sex. It should consist of two classes, the virtuous and the free-hearted. They must not know of each other and must be under the direction of men, but without knowing it, through good books and the later class, through the indulging of their passions in concealment." The Illuminati, of course, still proclaimed in their innocence, and though not attempting to deny the authenticity of these documents, declared that they had been misinterpreted, and that the real purpose of the order was to make of the human race, quote, "one good and happy family," which is a Jewish ideal. But the damning evidence their papers contained, and in fact, it's not a Jewish ideal, I'm sorry, it's a Jewish deception, which is espoused as an ideal. But the damning evidence their papers contained made the plan of the Illuminati only too clear, which was no other than to bring about the universal revolution that should deal the death blow to society. "Princes and nations," Weishaupt had written, "shall disappear off the face of the earth," and that they have. "Yes, the time will come when men will have no other laws than the book of nature. This revolution will be the work of the secret societies, and that is one of our great mysteries." The fearful danger presented by the Illuminati now became apparent. The government of Bavaria, judging that the best manner of conveying a warning to the civilized world would be to allow the papers to speak for themselves, ordered them to be printed forthwith and circulated as widely as possible. A copy of this publication, entitled Original Writings of the Order of the Illuminati, was then forwarded to every government of Europe, but, strange to say, attracted little attention, the truth being doubtless, as the Abbe Barul points out, that the extravagance of the scheme therein propounded rendered it unbelievable, and the rulers of Europe, refusing to take Illuminism seriously, put it aside as a chimera. The government of Bavaria, however, continued its proceedings against the sect. Several of its members were arrested. Zwack left the country on a mission to England. Well, we know what he did. Weishaupt, with a price set on his head, took refuge with one of his royal adepts, the Duke of Saxe-Gotha, who had to be, would he have to be an ancestor of Queen Victoria, I wonder? This apparent breakup of the society admirably served the purpose of the conspirators, who now diligently circulated the news that Illuminism had ceased to exist, a deception carried on ever since by interested historians anxious to suppress the truth about its subsequent activities. The truth is that not until Illuminism had been apparently extinguished in Bavaria was it able to make its formidable influence felt abroad, and public anxiety being allayed, it could secretly extend its organization over the whole civilized world. That ends chapter one of Nestor Webster's World Revolution.
I'm reading about Ernest II, Duke of Saxe-Gotha-Altenburg, It says here on Wikipedia that his Bavarian Illuminati name was Quintus Severus Andor Timoleon, and that he created the supervisor of Abyssinian, a name for Upper Saxony. In 1787, he granted Weishaupt asylum in Gotha. And I'm looking at his hook-nosed portrait, so that should tell you a little bit more about him.
Well, Victoria was from the house of Coburg Saxe-Gotha, and I'm wondering if there's a blood relationship there.
I would have to assume so. And, you know, I've seen some interesting quotes by the Jews over the years, and one in the Jewish World, February 9th, 1883, wrote, "The great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teachings, and that in a universal brotherhood of nations, a greater Judaism, in fact, all the separate races and religions shall disappear."
Well, that is Judaism. That's their goal, to destroy all races and religions so that they can rule the world.
"We Jews regard our race as superior to all humanity and look forward not to its ultimate union with other races, but to its triumph over them." Goldwin Smith, professor of modern history at Oxford University, October 1981.
And they profess the desire to destroy all the world's religions, but they really only can care about the destruction of Christianity. The Jew, the African witch doctor, the Chinese Shinto artist, and the Jews invented Islam. Islam is basically Talmudism for sand niggers.
They profess
exactly
a hatred of Muhammad, though, since he supposedly killed all the Jews in Mecca and Medina. Do you believe he actually did that?
Well, there is. I do believe that Muhammad had taken vengeance against the Jews in Mecca because they drove him out.
Hmm. So that was a personal issue.
He expected them to adopt Islam. And that's the reading I've done that convinces me most. Angle that convinces me most.
But Muslims have always gotten along with Jews up until this Palestine business recently, haven't they?
Well, yes, but Muhammad actually had a he had married Jews. He had hired Jewish scribes, and they wrote the Quran. Jews wrote the Quran.
Hmm.
He may have been a Jew in part by blood. And there are several ancient writers, not that ancient, but late medieval, the 1700s, the 18th. Edward Gibbon is one of them, who conjectures that Muhammad very possibly could have been a Jew by blood. And he expected the Jews of Mecca to adopt Islam readily. And basically they caused his flight from Mecca, and he came back with a vengeance. That's what I understand.
So that's probably what would have happened had Trotsky been able to return to the Soviet Union and have an army form around him. They'd have killed Stalin if they could have.
Right. Now the war with Sulla I was confused about before. That was actually his war was against Mithridates. Mithridates was the king of Pontus who rebelled against the Romans and actually killed 80,000 Romans in Anatolia. And Sulla defeated him. But then Sulla marched on Rome and basically took it over as a dictator.
Oh, and I Googled S-Y-L-L-A, since his name was S-U-L-L-A, and it said that with the Y, that's just the French version of his Latin name.
Yeah, the U and the Y are pretty much interchangeable between Greek and Roman and French writing.
All right, then, so we're going to resume next week with the next chapter.
Yes, because that's now we're getting into the nuts and bolts of the Illuminati and the Jews and the French Revolution.
Or if we can even call it the French Revolution.
It's not really a French Revolution.
They had enough Frenchmen to fill a horse carriage, it seems.
It's the Jewish takeover of France, just like the Bolshevik Revolution was the Jewish takeover of Russia.
And the revolution in Spain was the attempted Jewish takeover of Spain.
Absolutely.
But
The sexual revolution here in the 60s was the Jewish takeover of America. We got taken over by sex. I'm making a jest, but it's practically true.
Well, they figured it would work better than marching through the streets calling for blood in the streets.
Okay.
Haven't, the evil ones have always used sex, haven't they? They're panderers.
Well, yes, they have. But we were taken over with sex just like our first parents were.
All right, then. Thank you. Next week, then.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Yahweh bless.